The problem is that the on the insurance side, you couldn't really do as much to help people manage the care. And so the staggering statistics are that half of the people in the country are going to need long-term care.
Yeah.
And how do they pay for it? And a lot of them go broke in the process. And a lot of it relates to, you know, whether or not they're at home, whether or not they're in a facility. And so what I didn't like about my position in that was that I couldn't quite troubleshoot what was going on in the actual care delivery.
Privilege of sitting down with Gray Miller, founder and CEO of Titanium Healthcare. Gray has an awesome background as a U.S. nuclear sub-engineer for the U.S. Navy. Also, he served as a leader for General Electric internationally, including learning from the legendary Jack Welch. Gray's also a son, and unfortunately had to experience both of his parents being hospitalized and then readmitted. Gray had a lot of knowledge. His time at GE worked in healthcare. He knew there had to be a better way in our health system. Gray founded Titanium Healthcare. In today's episode, we're going to learn about data, about serving the chronically ill, and learning how IPAs can benefit from Gray's knowledge. Enjoy the show. If you want to reach out to the show, feel free to email us at info@pophealthpodcast.com. And you can find more episodes at pophealthpodcast.com or searching Pop Health Podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Please leave a review as well. Thanks so much. So, Gray, when we kick off the shows, one thing we like to learn is maybe something about our guests that the audience or even the coworkers would not know about them. So why don't you share something about yourself?
Well, I grew up in Ohio.
Okay.
Canton, Ohio, to be exact. The home of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, if you ever been?
I have not. I have not been there.
Well, it's really the home of the Pro Football Hall of Fame and not a lot else. So there's not a lot of reasons to really draw you to Canton, Ohio, but it's where I grew up. So
okay, great. And then I also heard you speak a couple times, and you've spent time not just on land in a landlocked area, but also out at sea in a submarine. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the first thing you'd have to think about with submarines is why would anybody do that? I don't think I really knew what I was getting into when I volunteered subs. But, you know, my main goal, I was going to be an IT guy. And I had a deck of cards in Fortran. And I was going to Bowling Green State University and dropped my midterm. And the rubber band snapped.
Uh-oh.
And I thought, you know, I'm not sure I've got the patience to retype 1,000 cards and go through the lines and all of that. I thought, I'm not sure I want to be an IT guy.
Okay.
So I decided I wanted to use my time productively, serve my country, and do something that sort of took me out of that landlocked area of Ohio and found the Navy.
So it was not right out of high school. You actually were in college first.
I was in college, but I decided that I didn't want to be an IT guy and really didn't know what I wanted to be.
Right.
And so I thought, well, why don't I try this? And so I walked into a recruiter station, and you know how in life you can kind of track yourself to, you know, you decided to go out that night or you didn't and your whole life changed.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to be Air Force. And I thought, well, okay, let me go down and talk to these guys. But they were gone for lunch.
Ah.
So I walked one door down and made the huge difference in my life because I started testing out. And they said, well, you did pretty well on this test, so take that test. And I became a nuclear candidate for the nuclear engineering program with the Navy. So
okay. So you ended up proceeding with your career in the Navy and nuclear subs. And what was the longest stay, I guess, inside a submarine?
Well, so my total time on subs was 3 years, a month, and 3 days.
How many hours and minutes?
6 hours, 15 seconds. Yeah. The Navy was a six-year hitch, and three of them were school.
Okay.
And the school boasted a two-thirds attrition. So if you can believe that, so they have these kids at the time going from to school from 11 at night to 7 in the morning. You know, we had a couple of suicides. I mean, it was a high-stress experience.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids were sort of living in the fear. I call them kids. They were grown-ups, but living in the fear that they wouldn't make it through the program and therefore would become nuclear waste, as we call it. I know this.
All right.
So you didn't want to become nuclear waste, and so you really wanted to make it. But by the time we were done, it was about two-thirds of the kids that actually failed out. But once we got on submarines, you know, that 3 years, we would be underwater for about 9 months a year.
Okay.
And the longest singular time we were underwater was about 85 days.
Wow.
So imagine what that feels like.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I think I've been in an indoor environment at the most for maybe 24 hours, and I was eager to get out after that. So
I would say it's an unnatural thing to do, to lock 130 22-year-old guys in a tin can for 85 days.
Yeah, I bet.
To say the least.
Well, I hope the folks listening can have a greater appreciation for our men and women in uniform on those subs. So, well,
yeah, somewhere out there right now as we speak, there's people on a sub, that's for sure.
Yeah. So you spent 6 years in the Navy.
Yeah.
I know we hear a lot about four-year stays and 20-year stays. So what, after 6 years, made you decide to leave or kind of enter the civilian world?
Well, with all respect, I did not like being underwater 9 months a year.
Yeah.
It was never a career decision for me to stay in the military. It was really a productive use of time and get a great education, serve my country, but then to get out and really pursue a career. And so my way of thinking and impetus was always to leverage the experience in the Navy, travel around, and then do something. And so I got out and went to the University of Maryland, worked a couple of jobs, went to school four nights a week. And because of the nuclear training, I had a company that paid everything.
It
was just wonderful. And I got it done in three and a half years and was able to then join General Electric. So it was really, I can't say enough good about the experience with the nuclear Navy and the competence of the people I worked with. And that really just created an ability to work as an engineer, a test engineer, getting out and then onward and upward kind of thing. So.
And so when you joined GE, this was in the early 90s.
Yeah, 93.
And at that time, many of you listening may know the name Jack Welch, who's often referred to in books. I believe I read Good to Great, and I think he's referenced in that book as well as a leader. I could have the wrong book. But you had the opportunity to work for a large company with him as a leader, and I was curious, during your time with GE, some of the things you've learned or any stories you can share with us working for a really well-respected group in its heyday back in the 90s.
Yeah, so first, the reason that I joined GE, I was either going to do a graduate program or I was going to do something related to a corporate training program. So okay. I was thinking about MBA programs. And my customer was GE's Knowles Atomic Power Lab.
Okay.
So when I was working in D.C. going to school as a test engineer, I worked with Knowles Atomic Power Lab in Ballston Spa, New York, which used to be a GE location.
Okay.
And they said, look, why don't you go on to financial management program with GE? It's 2.5 years of training. You get paid and you get the best training. And Jack Welch is our CEO. And man, is he something. And the things that they told me was that GE revered people who challenged the status quo.
Ah.
And I thought, well, you know, that sounds like me because I wasn't really very military, to be honest. But in the nuclear Navy, you had to be right, not necessarily military.
Okay.
And so it was a contradiction within the Navy. Competency was over military obedience.
Yeah.
For sure, in the nuclear forces.
Okay.
So in GE, that sounded very, very appealing to me. So I got onto this financial management program. And within a year was living in Shanghai as a CFO. Honestly, I could almost not spell CFO. You know, I was by attrition nominated to be the CFO for a startup business that was a manufacturing plant in Shanghai. But we figured it out. I had a lot of support from the people back in the States. And so I had this wonderful experience. And I was working with people over there who I read about in the Wall Street Journal. McNerney, Nardelli, Dennis Dammerman. And so as part of that program, I was at Fairfield for a Saturday class. And I walked out of the bathroom and saw a guy come just past me in the hallway. And somebody said, "Hey, do you see that? That was Jack." I'm like, "No, no." So I turned around and he was coming out. I said, "How you doing?" "Gray Miller." He said, "Jack Welch." He said, "What are you doing here on a Saturday?" And I said, "Well, I'm taking this class in stock valuations." And he said, "Well, come on, let's go." And so the group of us spent about 40 minutes with him, where he talked about how he works with Wall Street and manages expectations. And, you know, at the time, GE was trading at a PE of 38. But he spent
For the audience who's mostly healthcare professionals, explain what that means, a PE of 38.
Yeah, the price to the earnings. And so it's really it's a measure of confidence. And so our competitors within GE were trading at a price to earnings ratio of about 20.
Yeah.
GE was trading at 38. And it was all about their belief, their unqualified belief that GE was the best managed company in the world.
Yeah.
And so that demanded almost a twice as much premium on that stock price. And so Jack spent the time with his kids right out of college, shaping and forming. And that was really the GE, you know, 350,000 employees. And yet here is Jack Welch spending, you know, 40 minutes on a Saturday to mentor these kids. Moving forward, you know, Jack spent time. So if you made it up the ranks, then more and more you got exposure to Jack.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the times that I got to present to him was to tell him what he needed to do differently in Six Sigma. That was kind of a high risk proposition, really.
Absolutely.
But I had a belief, and you know what? He heard it and he agreed.
Great.
And he was that kind of guy. He yeah. could look at you and make you feel like you were on top of the world. Or conversely, if he didn't like you, then you felt like you were pretty small.
Yeah.
And that was the GE way. It was sort of move up or move out. And
yeah.
for some people, that was a thriving environment. And for others, it was less good. But I loved it. I
yeah.
just thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
Just an awesome experience.
Well, that's great. And so
yeah.
you spent a lot of time at GE. How did you transition your career from kind of engineering, strategy, numbers into healthcare?
So I guess getting back to these few moments in life where you really can tie it down to an epiphany or a seminal moment. My seminal moment, you know, I had traveled around to a lot of different countries and with GE working on different problems. And so we would go to a manufacturing plant in Brazil and look at the processes to figure out where inefficiencies lie. By the same token, we went to consumer finance, pet insurance, credit cards, all kinds of different businesses. And always with a view of sort of dissecting these big problems into smaller ones and then coming up with repairs and making the whole system work better.
Right.
So my epiphany was that I was working with a tank of PhDs, multiple PhDs who were modeling different applications of skip payment coupons for a credit card portfolio in Sweden.
Okay.
So the basic idea was let's scientifically figure out how often to mail people a skip payment coupon, because what that meant was they could skip a payment, which they would appreciate, but we could get more money out of them.
Due to interest, or they would spend more?
The interest would continue to accrue and they would get to skip a payment.
Yeah.
And my epiphany at that time was, you know, I don't want to make money this way in my life.
Yeah.
I really, you know, it's a great business and it serves a need, but that wasn't me.
Yep.
And so my epiphany at that point was I want to move somewhere where it makes a difference. And so within my purview was long-term care insurance. So I took a job in San Rafael, California, moving from London to run operations for long-term care insurance.
Within the GE family? Or?
Within the GE family. Okay. So it was, at the time, the nation's largest provider of long-term care insurance policies. And so in a given week, we would do about 3,500 applications.
Wow.
So it was big. Now, what's interesting about long-term care insurance is the average purchaser at the time was 62, but the average claimant was 82. So there's a 20-year span between the claimant and the purchaser. And a lot of things can change in the risk profile within that period, which I think weakened the knees of GE's appetite to be in that kind of risk.
Yeah,
I can't really blame them.
Yeah.
Imagine, you know, a drug that changes the progression of Alzheimer's, which is a wonderful thing, but changes the whole profile of the claim. So anyway, they spun off Genworth and wrapped up long-term care insurance, among other things, into an IPO called Genworth. So,
okay.
But that's how I found my way and passion into healthcare.
Good. So great transition. Now, as you transitioned to healthcare, did long-term care insurance, and throughout the years, you then decided to start this company called Titanium Healthcare. Tell us about that transition, and I'd be curious why the name Titanium and who your partners are.
Long-term care insurance gave me the passion around care. The problem is that on the insurance side, you couldn't really do as much to help people manage the care. And so the staggering statistics are that half of the people in the country are going to need long-term care.
Yeah.
And how do they pay for it? And a lot of them go broke in the process. And a lot of it relates to, you know, whether or not they're at home, whether or not they're in a facility. And so what I didn't like about my position in that was that I couldn't quite troubleshoot what was going on in the actual care delivery. So fast forward, I started up a company in Minnesota that was, it was really about care management for mine workers. It was the first Taft-Hartley Trust. And there I got really involved in the actual care delivery and the medical profile, like the pharmaceuticals that people were taking.
Yeah.
And got the real passion around it. And then took a job as a CEO of a hospitalist company. And hospitalists, of course, are the people who one sees in the hospital who really quarterbacks the care there.
Right.
And while that happened, both my parents were hospitalized at the same time. And they were in the hospital. I'm a hospitalist company CEO. My mom didn't understand her plan of care. The doc, she left the hospital. She didn't know what she needed to do to stay home.
Yeah.
My stepdad at the same time was in the same bucket. And so they try and get a primary care visit and they couldn't be seen for 3 weeks. And so my own parents were readmitted within 4 days of being discharged from the hospital. And I just thought, wow, you know, with all the access I have to docs, healthcare professionals, insider knowledge, I even met with a hospitalist who was treating my parents. He was looking for a job. But, you know, so why is it that me as an insider couldn't help my parents stay home?
Yeah.
And so that was really the spark that lit the flame about, we've got to be better. You know, hospitals are positioned to want you to sort of cost the least and to get you out as efficiently as possible. And there's very little incentive on their part to reduce the readmissions,
yeah,
in my opinion. And the primary cares are really about people who are generally well.
Yeah.
When somebody's generally sick, they take a lot of resources and a lot of time that the primary cares have a difficult time providing. So there's this gap within the hospitals and the primary care that's vital to helping people stay at home.
So sorry to interrupt, Gray, but one thing you said, and I've heard this before, you're saying it in a sense publicly.
Yeah.
But a hospital CEO over a big system in the East told me privately, but said, don't mention my name. Hospitals are not incentivized, in a sense, in your opinion, to really focus on readmission prevention. Am I rephrasing properly? Or feel
correct.
Free to correct me.
I think that the readmissions penalty is inadequate.
Yeah.
To change the behavior.
And the hospital CEO said the same thing. But what's funny is he's preaching publicly, right, about, oh, we got to reduce readmissions. But his own leaders, who are financially incentivized for the profits of the private hospital system, for example. So it seems like the incentives are not really aligned with what's needed. And so I'd be curious for you to touch a little bit more on that.
Sure. So first, I think that the readmissions penalty is a brilliant move. If collectively we're moving to a place where people who are more healthy are better, then empty hospitals are better, really, and people at home are better. And so I think the healthcare system really needs to make sure that we're focused in on more healthy people cost less. So hospitals, the idea that they would have to pay a readmission penalty is the right thing to do.
Right.
Now, the manner in which CMS went about it so far, to me, is inadequate, and here's why. First of all, they take 3 years of data, and they glom it into a massive ratio and say whether or not a hospital should suffer a readmissions penalty or not. The form that readmissions penalty takes is a discount on all Medicare payments to the hospital.
Right.
And so the problem with that is it's seen by the executives as, wow, it's 3 years. So even, you know, it's hard to move a 3-year number, one. Two, it's already there. So we're already taking the discount and the readmissions itself is still a triggers a revenue. So that piece of it is broken to me.
Right. So let's break that down into real numbers. Let's say a hospital traditionally gets $500 million payments from Medicare. And they're penalized, and they're getting great volume.
1%.
They're penalized 1%. It's up to 3 now, I believe.
Depending.
Yeah. So if they're controlling that properly, would it be fair, is what you're stating, that the penalty is so, that 1% or 2% or whatever it is so little that in the big scheme of things, that they're not really going to invest in the process to reduce the readmissions? Is that kind of something that is fair to say based on your opinion?
Well, I think 5 million, if it's a 1% or 10 million, is still a big nut.
Yeah.
And a lot of CEOs are really thinking about it. And there's a lot of folks that believe that, you know, the right thing to do is to reduce those readmissions. Two, a lot of hospitals are getting into risk pools where they share the risk with the IPAs or the health plans.
Yeah.
So they too share the incentive like a plan does to keep people better.
Okay.
And these are good movements towards, you know, what we ought to be doing. And so, but there are in extreme, you know, once that admissions or readmissions penalty is assessed, there's a long digging out process to get that money back. And so what I'm saying is that with a 3-year number, you know, some people are less focused on it than they should be. So.
Got it. So let's talk more about Titanium.
Sure.
So when you had that situation with your folks, I believe you were in Minnesota at the time. How did you move forward with Titanium? What is Titanium? And did you have support? Did you have co-founders?
Yeah. So this epiphany, what I was really, you know, I was flying back and forth to Houston. I was actually living here, Marin County.
Okay.
And my daughter, I was gone a lot. I was sort of Mr. 1K United, domestic.
Okay.
Which hurts. It hurts. It's like a scarlet letter if you're 1K. My daughter said, do you have to fly every week to Houston? You're never here. And I just thought, you know what? No. I'd rather be here for her pet parade and figure out something new.
Yeah.
And so I felt like it was sort of time for a change.
Okay.
Because, you know, I know some people in healthcare. I thought, all right, well, where do I want to play? And I kept coming back to this dearth of support for these people who are high risk with multiple chronic conditions and discharging and need the help to sort of stay successfully discharged. I kept coming back to that.
Okay.
And I wanted to do something that meant something. So that was sort of the overriding philosophies that carried into Titanium. So I quit my job and, I went to, you know, just thinking about and blueprinting the business. And so the Titanium, because I'm a nuclear survivor, call it, okay. Nuclear propulsion guy, I kept coming back to the periodic table. And I like titanium as an element. But the philosophy was breaking out this big problem into granular pieces and then managing those pieces to a better end. And so I kept coming back to titanium and the periodic table, and the name had a ring to it. When we got to the clinics, I was concerned that if we didn't present it right, and particularly to a Medi-Cal or Medicaid population, that we wanted to make sure it was understandable what we were trying to do for folks who we were going to get as patients. And so I really thought about what would be understandable and kept coming back to, if you meet certain criteria, you get extra care, extra support. The doc will give you extra time. You can have an hour of appointment time with your doctor. And so that kind of gelled and finally became the Titanium Extra Clinics. So that's what we call it. Titanium Extra is our clinic group.
And where are your clinics?
Well, we have downtown Los Angeles. We've got Lakewood. I've got two more opening up between now and the end of the year. So we're pretty excited. It's been a good thing.
So how would you define titanium to a layperson? Let's say I'm not in healthcare. I say, what is titanium? How would you, in a 30-second elevator speech, if you will?
Yeah, titanium gives people who need extra support a dedicated doc and an intense care management program. The doc and the care management are there to help them stay out of the hospital. And so we carve out people that have 5+ chronic conditions, high cost per year. So they're out of control. They use the emergency room as their doctor. You know, you feel sick, you go to the emergency room, you go to urgent care. But we take them and we say, hey, we're going to book you an appointment. It's an hour appointment. Wow. We'll listen to all your questions. No hurry.
So how does someone become a part of this titanium? I know the healthcare system is so complex to navigate. So let's say I have Medicare or Anthem or Medi-Cal. Can I qualify? Or how do I?
Yeah, what we do is we actually have partnerships with about 15 IPAs here in the greater LA area.
Okay.
And so what we do is we identify these people through care management. So typically they're the ones that are frequenting the ER, they've been hospitalized, they have three or four chronic conditions, they got a high cost, and we will come to them either in the hospital or we'll call them up and say, hey, we're going to set you up as part of your hospitalization program, this post-discharge visit, this doctor who will give you what you need. Since we've started, we've been running surveys, and I find this fascinating. And out of all the surveys, about 120 of them, we've only had one that was less than 5 out of 5. And, you know, I would love to say that it's because we have this magic Kool-Aid, that people want somebody who just cares and a doc who's not in a hurry. And the system of paying a lot of docs makes a natural sort of impetus to have to see a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the way we hire our docs and the way we pay our docs gives them all the runway they need to spend the hour or the hour and 15 minutes they need to reconcile the meds. We had a patient last week. They had a blood thinner from their primary care, a blood thinner from the cardiologist, and another blood thinner from the hospitalization. Now, nobody was quarterbacking that. This patient's got three of them. We tell them, bring your pill bottles in and let's reconcile your meds. You know, and that happens all the time,
right?
All the time.
So for these high-risk patients, after a hospitalization or during an episode, do they just stay with titanium for just a period of time, or are these folks on titanium, in a sense, forever?
Yeah, so one of the things that's very important to distinguish is that titanium is not primary care.
Yeah.
You know, the primary care network works well, and we're not trying to be a primary care. What we really are is a specialist clinic.
Okay.
And so our remit in all of this is to get a patient, two sources. So one is the high risk who might or might not have been hospitalized. Give them this private doc, if you will, and dedicated care management, and get them tuned up.
Okay.
You know, help them with their medicine reconciliation. Help them. You know, we had a guy a couple weeks ago. He said, hey, you know, when I feel badly, I go to MLK and they fix me right up. And he needed a breathing treatment.
Yeah.
And that was the way he got his care. So we can tune those folks up and then hand them back into the primary care network. That's our goal. So the high-risk medical home is, you know, a 6 to 8 month kind of length of stay where we'll see them and stay with them for a while, get their A1Cs where they need to be or whatever they need,
okay,
and then transition them to primary care. On the other side is the post-discharge side. Now, that's a 30-day focus where we help them in that gap between the hospital and the primary cares, stabilize them, help them with their plans of care and their hospitalization, the reasons they were hospitalized, and then get them back to primary care.
Okay. And then you mentioned you're in downtown Los Angeles and Long Beach, and you're opening two new locations later this year.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same area or?
Orange County.
Okay.
Orange County. But, you know, I guess what we've got to do is make sure that we get them in the places where the patients are. And so part of our, call it core fabric, is that we have really good analytics to show us where these patients are. So as we talk to a potential customer, an IPA, we can get the data and show them, hey, you've got a hot area of cost here in Long Beach related to COPD and CHF.
And for those listening, think of a heat map,
yeah,
right? I think on your
map.
On,
exactly.
On your presentations I've seen previously, you see a high density of red or orange. I forget the color you use, but...
Yeah, red.
Yep.
Like a skin rash.
Yeah.
A rash of cost. And, you know, the more these folks need help in a particular area, as a nuclear guy, what I want is a blinking light on a control panel that says that somebody needs help.
Yeah.
You know, one plan I saw, somebody who repeatedly went to the hospital and cost the plan $2.7 million.
Yeah.
And that light didn't go on. You know, and knowing that that patient is there and in need should, in my view, get in place a whole bunch of emergency actions, much like a submarine where a pipe is leaking. Let's jump on it and help them stay home.
Yeah.
But that requires time and a process to support them. So.
Okay. So tell us about the payment structure for a titanium. You mentioned you work with 15 IPAs.
Uh-huh.
Are the IPAs your client and you receive reimbursement there? Is it the insurance plans? Can you tell us, walk us through how you guys are reimbursed?
Yeah. Well, at first, the model really, again, alignment being key. And we can talk about some of the misalignments in healthcare, but the alignment is the key. To, I think, any system, whether it's a manufacturing system or a financial system or a healthcare system, people need to be aligned to the goals of the organization. And so when we put titanium together, it was really with a view that we wanted to remove that production component and put in place a quality component for the docs who provide the care.
Okay.
And so for that reason, we chose, you know, to put them on a salary and then an incentive structure related to the value we create. If you go up a level for the clinic, the same thought process really applies. A basic fee structure and then an incentive to align with the interests of the plan. I would be loath to celebrate a success if it wasn't with the partner client celebrating the success too.
Yeah.
And so if there's not a direct connection between their definitions of success and ours, then something is materially broken, and we don't want that. So the way we accomplish that is through a fee structure, be it case rates or fee-for-service medicine, which is a traditional clinic,
okay,
and then an incentive on top of that.
Okay.
It just depends on the interests of the client and where they are in the continuum of wanting to share risk and where we are in a maturity of our relationship.
So, and forgive me if I missed it in your explanation, are your clients considered the IPA or the plan or both, depending on circumstances?
Well, IPAs are by themselves risk entities.
Right.
And so what I like about IPAs is they can move quite quickly relative to some of the times and review structures that plans have to put in play. So the ability to contract with IPAs is generally better, I say better, quicker,
okay,
than it is with plans.
Okay.
So the IPAs, you know, we've got 15 of them, we've got a plan, we've got an ACO, but really it's the same thought process. If they have risk, they call it institutional and professional risk, if they have risk, and they have readmissions, then we can be a partner to them to help their folks get better care and stay out of the hospital, which will cost less.
Yeah, that makes sense. And yeah. I think with these IPAs and your partners, you have a pool of how many lives, would you say, so far?
Well, the IPAs in the total are about 1.1 million lives. And so it's kind of a big deal. One of our IPAs has half of the homeless within Los Angeles.
Wow.
And what's amazing to me is you see the people come into the clinic And, you know, somebody's homeless and non-compliant who goes into the hospital. And yet the outcomes are compelling. You know, what is an average of 20% readmissions into a hospital within 30 days of that hospitalization? The people we see, it's 5%.
Which you're okay with, but I think you mentioned, I heard you say earlier, that's not good, or that's not your ultimate goal.
Well, yeah, I think a readmission is a failure. I think the team takes it quite personally that if we could have done anything better and avoided a readmission. So we go back and really look at these actual readmissions. What happened? Why did that person? You know, there are people who are willfully non-compliant.
Right.
But a large majority of them don't want to stay in the hospital. They want to stay home if they can. And so we really look hard to see. I think that number could be 2 or 3%.
Yeah.
I really do. But we have to tighten up a lot of the sort of psychiatric support for some of these substance abuse.
Yeah.
So there's areas where we really need to do a better job. But I think 5% is a good start on a clinic that we opened in middle of September last year. So it's less than a year old.
That's good, Gray. Well, we're coming to the end of our episode. If people want to learn more about Titanium Healthcare, how do they learn more? How do they get connected?
Yeah, well, our website is tihealthcare.com. The clinic website is titaniumextra.com.
Okay.
And we'd love to entertain questions, you know, and thoughts about our model and our results, and love to hear from people. So.
Very good. Well, Gray was up early this morning flying in from, was it Monterey Airport?
Monterey, yeah.
We're recording here in El Segundo right by LAX. I know you're visiting your clinics, I believe, and partners later this week. So, Gray, we really appreciate you stopping by on the way down to your team. And again, what's that website one more time for both your organization and the clinics?
Yeah, tihealthcare.com, like titanium, tihealthcare.com. And the clinic website is titaniumextra.com.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. Gray Miller has been our guest. If you do like this episode or would like to listen to other episodes of Pop Health Podcast, please visit pophealthpodcast.com, where you can also find us on Stitcher and iTunes. And we love when you leave a review and likes as well. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-hour home care.